Welcome to the Queensland Economy Watch special audio edition. My name's Gene Tunney. Today, I'm going to be talking with one of the authors of a new Menzies Research Centre paper, COVID-19, Getting Australia Safely Back to Work. The author is my old friend and former Treasury colleague, Joe Brannigan, Director of Tulipwood Economics. Joe, good to be chatting with you again.
Great to be with you again, Gene. How are you?
Excellent. Thanks, Joe. Joe, I'm really looking forward to our discussion. I read Nick Cater's piece in The Australian yesterday and I thought, terrific, this paper's finally out. It's been in development for a while now and I've been looking forward to it coming out. I'd like to begin by asking you to imagine you've been called into the PM's office. The PM's had a detailed briefing on your report prepared for him, but he hasn't had time to read the briefing. The PM asks you, what's it all about, Joe? Could you tell the PM what's it all about, please?
Well, PM, I guess there's two key points. One is stay the course with suppression because elimination is not a viable option. And the second point is that at the right time, we should review what we've done and learn the lessons. So they're basically the two points of the paper. And you're right, Gene, it was a long time in development because, as you well know, the situation was changing daily, even hour by hour for many weeks through February, March and April. But we're happy the paper's out and we think this is probably an appropriate time given what's happening in Victoria and to a lesser extent in New South Wales and the debate around what we now call suppression versus elimination is heating up again. And so I think it's an appropriate time to just take a step back and talk about this from a broader public policy perspective.
Okay, Joe, could we just chat about this suppression versus elimination debate quickly? Now, I think Grattan Institute came out the other day and they said, well, we've got the opportunity now to eliminate the virus if we do the right thing. Of course, that depends on how Victoria goes. We've had over 300 cases today, so very concerning. You're saying that there's just no way we're going to be able to eliminate the virus without imposing, you know, more costs on the economy, and therefore suppression is the only real option. But what does suppression look like? Do you have any thoughts on what does it mean? Like practically, what does suppression mean in policy terms?
Well, I think the first point to make is I think that from the perspective of the Prime Minister, the State Premiers, the National Cabinet, it's very much everyone is aligned in terms of their view about suppression. I think the Premier said, I think the Queensland Premier said even earlier today that, you know, everyone would love to have elimination, but it's just not realistic. And I think the Prime Minister said the same thing. Elimination is just not a viable option. You know, very rarely do corner solutions give you the right answer in public policy. And I think the problem is that those who argue for elimination, and there are many that still do, have the wrong counterfactual in mind. That they assume that the alternative is to do absolutely nothing. And they also assume that the true infection fatality rate is 1%, which is what we originally thought it was all the way back in late January and early February. So the argument goes something like, well, we need elimination to save 150,000 lives. We need stage four. We need to reseal our borders. Otherwise, you know, this human tragedy occurs. But I think that's wrong because we've learnt a lot more about the virus since January. We've introduced the stage one, the stage two measures, and that's dramatically curtailed the spread of the virus. So you know, we have control over this virus in terms of a national, from a national perspective now. And the estimated infection fatality rate, if you think about the number of asymptomatic cases, the infection fatality rate is much lower than 1%. It's probably no more than 0.5%. So if you think about Australia's example, we have 111 deaths and 10,300 or so cases. So that gives you a 1% case fatality rate. But even if you took a minimum estimate of the number of asymptomatic cases, say Professor Doherty is saying, well, it would be 2 to 3 times the number of cases you're picking up, then that drops the infection fatality rate from 1% down to 0.33%. So we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of avoided deaths as the benefit here. It's magnitudes lower. On the other side is the cost to the economy. So you ask me, what does suppression looks like? Suppression looks local. It's that principle of subsidiarity. You're responding locally. You're investing your resources in tracking and tracing and quarantine. If there's an outbreak, you jump on it. It's reactive. It's not preemptive because the cost is so high to stay in that siege mentality, that preemptive place, which is the elimination strategy. It reacts, but it reacts quickly, and it allows people that are not that are still not a high risk to get on with their lives. So it's about locally shutting down areas, not closing state borders. That's a well-known example, or, you know, this is a sticking point or a debating point about borders. I think that suppression is about looking at things locally and managing, but accepting that you will have, you're not going to have zero cases a day for a long time yet. And you know, this virus, it's sneaking around the country. I just can't see that we could practically eliminate the virus because the cost would be too high to bear.
Okay, so you're talking about local responses now. It looks like that means we have to lock down the whole of metropolitan Melbourne. That's what's happening at the moment. What do you think about what Dan Andrews is doing? I mean, we'll leave aside the fact that they made mistakes and that's led to this outbreak. So we acknowledge that. Sure. What about the decision to reimpose the lockdowns? Is he doing the right thing?
I think if that's the advice and he's balanced it, you know, against these suppression objectives, then that's fair enough for him to do because it's local and it's targeted and there's clearly an outbreak. So, you know, I don't want to argue against the medical advice, you know, on the kind of this case-by-case basis. The general point is that the response needs to be local and it needs to be scalable and matched to the potential. And clearly, you know, when you're getting today there were, I think, 317 cases. So you're getting this rise. You need to jump on it quickly. The question is whether the 6 weeks is too long. I mean, 6 weeks gives you three cycles of the virus, you know, from testing to you know, recovery. So you know, my sense is that perhaps 6 weeks is too long, but you know, they can always change that if they jump on top of this thing early. So, you know, I'm not against that strategy. It's reactive, it's scalable, and it's local. And you know, I guess these are some of the advantages of a federation where we can have a national cabinet come together, but they can make local decisions.
Okay. Joe, would you know what the difference is between those different stages? I'm sure you do, and you probably put it in your report, but it'd be helpful to know because it's a bit unclear to me. There's a stage three and then there's stage four. Stage four is the harshest, is that right?
Well, I guess, yeah, they get more and more draconian. I think we're in stage three now. There's restrictions on gatherings. You know, there's, I think for most states at the moment, it's been increased to 300 to 500. There's the one person per four square meter rule. I think some of these kind of individual or very personal recommendations or rules may stay for many months. You know, they might even be semi-permanent through particularly bad flu seasons, etc. But obviously, you know, when you're getting up to complete lockdowns, I think at the moment in stage three, there's four reasons that you're allowed to go out, including, I think, work and study if you're able to. Stage four would be more of a complete lockdown where you basically can't go out, similar to what happened in the towers in Melbourne. That would be, I guess, a localised version of what would happen, which would be, you know, catastrophic if that were to happen across the whole country for 6 weeks.
Mm. So, Joe, you mentioned before that the fatality rate is actually, instead of being 1%, it's possibly a third of a percent. So if I remember what they were saying at the beginning of this pandemic, they were saying that COVID-19 is 10 times deadlier than the flu. So you're saying instead of 10 times, it's still three times, it's rather three times deadlier. What do we know? Well, yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, you don't know the true infection fatality rate. You know the case fatality rate, which is, you know, the number of positive cases divided by the number of tests. But that gives you an overestimate of the true infection fatality rate because it's biased towards people that are showing symptoms. You also know the population fatality rate. You divide the number of people that have lost their lives divided by the whole population. But that gives you an underestimate because you're including a very large proportion of the population that haven't been infected. So the true infection fatality rate is very hard to determine. But from you know the literature I've read and what I've seen overseas, it's somewhere between you know that very bad flu season of 0.1%, and that assumes that the number of asymptomatic cases is much higher, you know, 10 times higher than the number of people testing positive, up to about 1%, where you're assuming that you're pretty much capturing everyone, you're pretty much testing everyone that actually has the virus, which I think clearly we're not. I think Australia's only tested, we've had 3 million tests to date. So we're not, we're nowhere near testing every single Australian. So the true infection fatality rate lies somewhere between the case fatality rate, which we know, which is 1%, and the population fatality rate, which is very, very low. It's 0.4 in 100,000. So it's, you know, it's 0.00004. So nobody knows, but the best estimates are around that 0.5% mark, and I think if you applied that, you get a much lower number of avoided deaths as your benefit to these lockdowns than you would if you simply said, well, let's multiply 1% by 60% of the Australian population to 100% of the Australian population, which gives you 150,000 to 250,000 deaths. I think that's not the plausible counterfactual given all the work that's been done since January to try and suppress the virus.
Okay. Joe, earlier you mentioned that you think that the border closures along the lines of state borders were misguided. Can I just ask you, what did you do in your report? Is it a cost-benefit analysis? Have you undertaken a cost-benefit analysis, or are you just reaching this conclusion? This is your gut feeling on the net benefits of particular policies.
That's right. This is just a principle. This is the principle of subsidiarity, you know, applying this localized principle and reacting. So there hasn't been, a detailed, you know, proper cost benefit analysis of how the Australian government's reacted to coronavirus. I'm sure there will be one undertaken at the right time, but this report is based on first principles, and the principle is that elimination as a kind of a corner, as an extreme corner solution, as we call it in, you know, in mathematics or in economics, is just too costly. We recognise that cabinets always, every day, must weigh up the costs and benefits of the choices that are in front of them, and coronavirus is no different. So, this report argues to stay the course with the suppression strategy based on, those fundamental public policy principles, that you need to balance the costs and benefits of policy choices.
Okay. Regarding the costs of coronavirus, is it still the case that the more we learn about this virus, the more worried we are about it? Because there are some pretty frightening stories about just how badly people are being affected by it, the people who survive. And there are concerns that there may be long-term health consequences. Have you thought about that, what that could mean, and how does that affect the decision-making by our political leaders?
So are you talking about someone that's had coronavirus and then continues with health problems?
Yes. Well, there are all these reports that people are getting long-term lung, kidney, damage to other organs. Is that something you've looked at, or is it just too early to tell?
Well, the principle would apply that if the benefits, that is the number of avoided deaths, has been overestimated, then the benefits of the quality adjusted life years that you're avoiding have also been overestimated, because they would be correlated. In terms of people's underlying health and comorbidities, what the research is saying that I've seen tends to point in the other direction. It's the fact that people with heart, lung, circulatory problems, which is also correlated with age, of course, are more likely to get coronavirus, are more likely to be badly affected by it, and their death rates are much higher. I think that some of the studies in Italy and Spain are showing that, you know, if you're carrying three or four serious comorbidities, then, and you know, you're elderly, then you are very unlikely to make it. So what I've seen, the causality is going the other way. But you're right. I mean, it's still unknown about how people make full recoveries. There was a paper that came out, I think, the day before yesterday, a preprint. As you know, a lot of academic papers are getting published without peer review, obviously to get the information out. And that paper was saying that the antibodies that we developed to maintain our resistance to coronavirus decline quite rapidly over a number of weeks or months, and therefore, we could get it again. But I think that, that paper, as well as the arguments about the second wave in Victoria and possibly New South Wales, you could take that information and argue either case. You could say, oh, well, that proves that we need an elimination strategy because this thing just hangs around forever. Or you could argue, well, this thing is hanging around forever and therefore an elimination strategy is too costly and we should, choose to stick with the suppression strategy. The view that Henry and I took in this paper is the latter view, but other people are looking at that same evidence and saying, "No, we need to kill this thing off,
okay,
as soon as possible."
Yeah, by Henry, I should have mentioned earlier, Well, you mean Henry Ergas, who is your co-author. So Henry Ergas, very distinguished Australian economist that you've been working with for a while and is your co-author of this Menzies Research Centre paper, COVID-19, Getting Australia Safely Back to Work. Okay. Joe, I'll just ask one more question before we'll try and wrap up because I've picked your brain quite a bit already. I was watching a YouTube video earlier on how different countries have responded to coronavirus. It's a CNN video. And it looks like the countries that have been successful, well, they're the ones where they've managed to convince the public regarding the benefits of social distancing, regarding mask wearing. In Australia, we seem to have forgotten the importance of social distancing as we started relaxing the restrictions. There isn't widespread wearing of masks. Do our authorities need to be stronger in forcing us to socially distance, to wear masks if we go into public? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think you're right in your observation. And I think that, wearing masks, personal hygiene, personal social distancing, all of those things at the personal level, at the local level, are excellent strategies. And they involve a little bit of individual responsibility. So I think there's obviously a role for governments and health authorities to encourage as strongly as possible for people to take those actions because it drastically reduces the probability of the virus spreading. So as much as we can, I think we should avoid mandating because I think there's a long-term cost in a liberal democracy for the state telling people what to do. People are willing to accept it, especially in a national emergency, for reasonably long periods of time. But I think you're starting to pull at the fabric of our democracy if you took that kind of top-down mandated approach. But, I think you're right. I mean, these basic health and hygiene measures will be with us for many years. I think that governments will encourage them now through flu seasons, especially if the results of this year's flu season, are very mild because of all the social distancing that's been done as a result of COVID. That's a bit of a spillover benefit. But, from my looking at the worst countries, it seems to me that I'm just looking at a chart here of population fatality rate that I've drawn up, deaths per 100,000 people. Belgium's the worst at 83.7, then the UK, Italy, Spain, Sweden, France, US, Netherlands, Ireland. I mean, a lot of those European countries, they share a border with another country. They have populations that are more elderly than Australia. They have higher rates of smoking, higher rates of comorbidity. So, some of these countries where the virus got in early, the populations are much more fragile, I think, than the Australian population, much more densely packed in as well. So, there are many things affecting the infection fatality rate. And I think, in a sense, Australia's been lucky that we locked our overall border, our international border early. We tripled our ICU capacity fairly early, and we ramped up our ability to track and trace very fast. And that leaves us in a good position to, try and stay the course on the suppression strategy.
Absolutely, yes. I've thought of a couple of other questions, Joe. So I was just thinking about the Spanish flu in 1819. So you look at all the photos, the old black and white photos, and everyone's wearing masks. Do we know how much deadlier that was than COVID-19? I mean, it did spread out of control. So suppose everyone thought, well, we've got to wear a mask because we can see our relatives, our friends getting it. We do need to be careful. Do we know yet how deadly or how transmissible COVID-19 is compared with the Spanish flu?
The information is there. I can't recall it off the top of my head. Obviously, the Spanish flu was very deadly in effect. They had similar measures. I mean, they had the masks. They quarantined people. I know in New York, they actually put messages in newspapers telling people that this family is officially quarantined in their home and not allowed to leave, or they put signs outside of people's homes. I think you know, the Spanish flu spread, as everyone knows, because of the aftermath of World War One. We didn't have access. We were 100 years away from kind of access to, you know, real time immediate information about the dangers of the virus and where it was and what it was doing. So it could hit you with a second wave. It could sneak into a city. I mean, we have a lot more tools at our disposal to try and stop that now. So, you know, you wouldn't expect the coronavirus to have the impact that the Spanish flu had. I think at the moment, it's 560 or 70,000 deaths attributed to coronavirus, so it's well below.
Mm.
I think the Spanish flu was 30 to 50 million, I think the estimates are.
Yeah. Okay, let's chat about your recommendations. Is one of your recommendations that we need to do this comprehensive cost-benefit analysis where we look at what were the costs of the restrictions that were imposed and all of those indirect costs? I mean, there are people talking about how the unemployment can lead to it can lead to anxiety, depression, that could lead to suicide. There are possibly delays in people getting cancer treatments or getting investigated for diseases. Is that one of your recommendations? We need a comprehensive cost-benefit analysis where you've got to draw in economists and public health experts, Joe?
No, I think a full-blown cost-benefit analysis will come, whether it's commissioned by the government or it's done independently, you know, by an academic institution or a think tank. Who knows? But I don't think that's the most important thing. I mean, what will that tell you? It will either tell you you were exactly right, okay, or it'll tell you you were wrong. I mean, who cares? It's already been done. So I think the more important recommendations we make are to review, you know, the individual decisions and try and learn the lessons. So, for example, we've recommended that the National Cabinet should commission a report on national preparedness and develop a strategy of national preparedness, you know, looking at civil preparedness across the board in terms of the capacity to fund and recover from the cost of natural disasters and health emergencies like the pandemic. So these are not really saying, well, we should do a cost-benefit analysis of, you know, we should evaluate all your decisions this year. I mean, that will come, but I don't think that's the right time. This is about trying to very quickly learn some lessons from this that we can actually implement going forward. And I think the key recommendation in terms of lessons learned is that report on national preparedness, which we've recommended the Productivity Commission undertake, because it's uniquely placed with its investigative processes to have those, you know, those public and transparent hearings.
Right. What do you mean by national preparedness, Joe? Do you mean having enough ventilators, making sure you have the PPE? What exactly would national preparedness entail? What would it involve?
Well, it would entail that, but also looking at natural disasters like the summer bushfire season. This is not military preparedness. This is about civil preparedness to shocks such as a pandemic, such as a very bad flu season, such as a summer bushfires, floods and cyclones in Queensland, etc. So, just to you know, build on the work. Some of there's been even some very recent work done. I think there was a 2019 paper on pandemic preparedness prepared by the Department of Health. So it's building on that and taking a stock take of where we're at and trying to learn some of the lessons from this current pandemic. You know, and I'm sure there's many lessons to be learned from this, you know, very complex journey that we've been through this year.
Yeah. What I've been impressed by is just how well, or it appears they've been working well together. The premiers and the prime minister have been doing, how they've been going with that national cabinet. That seems to have gone reasonably well. There were a couple of disputes I remember early on. You compare Australia with the United States, which is just a complete disaster. And the national government there, the Trump administration's just stopped. They're not really providing any leadership anymore. It's just absolutely extraordinary. So, I mean, we'd probably look pretty good in any ranking of national preparedness around the world. Would that be a fair assessment?
Well, I think in the Westminster system, there's more a greater concentration in executive power, so that so the Westminster system perhaps arguably can respond to national emergencies better than a system in the United States, where the president of the United States actually doesn't have that much power. It's shared with the Congress in terms of raising money bills and the Supreme Court, and probably more importantly, the states. The states have a lot of control over, similar to Australia, in terms of, curfews and closing borders, and their health departments would undertake the tracking and tracing. It wouldn't be at a national level. So I guess the US faces similar problems. I mean, it's a much more argumentative society at the moment, and it's much larger, and dealing with the outbreak in New York was similar to dealing with an outbreak in the whole of Australia. The United States, their population fatality, they've had the most deaths, but their population fatality rate ranks seventh after, so Belgium, United Kingdom, Italy, Spain, Sweden, France, and then the United States at 35.5 deaths per 100,000. So it's 70 or 80 times higher than Australia, and it's about 10 times, it's 5 times the weighted average across the leading 77 countries and 10 times the median. So they're on the wrong side in terms of the performance, but they're by no means the worst. I mean, they're less than half Belgium and about two-thirds of the United Kingdom, Italy and Spain.
Right. Where are those stats coming from, Joe?
The stats I use in my database are taken from Johns Hopkins and then the official Australian data.
Okay. Excellent. So you've got your own COVID-19 database there.
I'll send it to you, Gene.
Excellent. Yeah. I know that's good. Could be good advertising for you, Joe. If anyone needs COVID-19 data and international comparisons, Joe Brannigan of Tulipwood Economics is fully across it. Okay, Joe, any final points before we close?
Well, I guess going back to your first question, the point of the paper by the time it was released was really that at least in my view and Professor Ergas's view, that staying the course with the suppression strategy is the right way to go. Because the elimination strategy is not a viable option. And, at the appropriate time in the future, we should review what we've done in 2020 and really try and learn all the lessons moving forward.
Okay. Joe Brannigan from Tulipwood Economics, thanks so much for your time. That was really informative. And well done.
Pleasure,
on the paper.
Gene. Thanks, mate.
Good on you.